Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schlohm. When I was a kid growing up in the 1960s, much like Tom Hanks, my heroes were the NASA astronauts, especially the Apollo astronauts who flew the moon missions from 1968 to 1972. They were all amazing, but for me, one of them always stood out as my personal favorite, Jim Lovell. James A. Lovell Jr. passed away at the age of 97 earlier this year. He was the epitome of calm grace under pressure, but he also had the rare gift of eloquence and a genuine scientific curiosity about space and exploration. No memory is more vivid from my childhood than the magical Christmas Eve in 1968 when Lovell and his Apollo 8 crewmates Frank Borman and William Anders became the first human beings to orbit the moon and see the Earth from deep space with their own eyes.
Roger, while looking at yourselves as seen from 180,000 miles out in space.
Mike, what I keep imagining is if I'm a lonely traveler from another planet, what I think about the Earth from this altitude, whether I think it'd be inhabited or not.
At that time, Lovell was NASA's most experienced astronaut in terms of flight time in space, serving with Borman on Gemini 7 and commanding Gemini 12 with crewmate Buzz Aldrin. He was famously portrayed by Tom Hanks in the 1995 Ron Howard film Apollo 13. The movie dramatized the survival story of the mission that was nearly lost when an explosion in the Apollo service module's oxygen tanks led to the crippling of the spacecraft. Lovell and his crewmates, Fred Hayes and Jack Swigert, made it back to Earth safely thanks to the incredible bravery and fortitude of the astronauts, along with the ingenious leadership of NASA flight controllers in Houston in 1970. Lovell retired from active flight duty in NASA immediately after that mission, but he went on to live an incredibly full life of adventures and family with his late wife, Marilyn. We'll look back at the life of Jim Lovell with three people who knew him well, including his eldest daughter Barbara and retired NASA flight director Jerry Griffin. But first, we're joined by Andrew Chaikin. Chaikin is one of the leading authorities on the history of NASA, and his 1994 book, A Man on the Moon, was the basis for the Tom Hanks-produced HBO miniseries From the Earth to the Moon. Chaikin also attended the memorial service for Lovell at the Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland in October. Andy Chaikin, welcome once again to Blue Dot.
Thank you, Dave. It's always great to be part of the show.
Well, when Jim Lovell passed away in August, I knew I wanted to do something about him, but I wanted to give it a little time for us all to kind of reflect and have a respectful period of time before we dive into it. I'm wondering, you know, you interviewed all of the astronauts for your book, spent so much time working on this. And Andy, you were a consultant on the HBO miniseries From the Earth to the Moon. You interviewed all the astronauts. I'm wondering, you know, what was your first memories of meeting and talking to Jim Lovell?
Well, you know what? I actually met Jim for the first time when I was in high school.
Wow.
And I went down to see the Apollo 17 launch, and I was picking up my VIP pass, which in those days, you could write to your congressman and get a VIP pass, and I'd found out about this. And so there he was in the visitor center, and I got an autograph from him. And, you know, that was kind of, it's always amazing to meet one of your heroes. And of course, Jim was one of my heroes. And I think about Jim as being the kind of quintessential astronaut from my childhood. You know, he just seemed like the essence of an astronaut, but also he was more present in the world, in the public eye, with kind of impressions of spaceflight. And, you know, he would talk about it. And then when the mission happened, when Apollo 8 happened, you know, I was glued to the set. It was when I was 12 years old. I was in seventh grade. And man, I just remember Jim being, and we can talk a little more about this, but Jim was, to me, the voice of that mission. There were so many times when I'd hear his voice, you know, during the TV transmissions that they sent back on the way to the moon and in orbit around the moon and on the way home. And so Jim had this special place in my mind and in my heart because I had grown up with him as such an important part of, you know, watching this incredible adventure unfold.
Yeah, and it's interesting to think back that Jim, you know, in the original selection of the first seven Mercury astronauts, Jim was in the running for that. And then he had a high bilirubin count that knocked him out of, you know, medically. But then he did come back for the second selection of the nine astronauts. It's just quite amazing to think of him. I think the word quintessential astronaut, I think that's perfect. One of the things that strikes me about him is he could wax poetic. He could convey a sense of adventure and his scientific curiosity, which really, to me, it set him apart from the other astronauts.
Bingo. That's exactly what I feel about him. And, you know, when I talked to him for the book, he was the only one of the guys who went to the moon who had a fascination with space, with astronomy, with rocketry as a boy and as a teenager. He actually built his own homemade rockets, you know, with stuff he got from the chemistry lab in high school and, you know, in a cardboard mailing tube and, you know, blew up a couple of them. Fortunately, wasn't injured, he and his friend, Jim Siddons. And, you know, his mother was worried enough to ask his girlfriend, Marilyn, who later became his wife, is there any way you can get him to stop fooling around with these things? And, of course, she couldn't. But, you know, he had a fascination that was unique among the astronauts. And he actually set his sights on becoming a rocket engineer. And I think he probably would have tried to go to a place like MIT, but they didn't have the money. His father had died when he was very young. So he ended up going to the Naval Academy. And what is amazing about the way life works out, it is precisely because he became a naval aviator that he ended up being in a position to be selected as an astronaut. And then, of course, you know, eventually become part of the first flight to go to the moon. So it's just amazing how those things work out. But yes, to me, Jim was the everyman on Apollo 8 because he was so open to the adventure, because he didn't mind verbalizing that. And I have such vivid memories of those amazing television transmissions when Apollo 8 was on the way to the moon and they were showing us what the Earth looked like. And Jim at one point said, you know, he was talking to Mike Collins, who was the Capcom in Mission Control, and he said, Mike, what I keep imagining is if I'm some lonely traveler from another planet, you know, whether I looking at the Earth from this distance, whether I would think it was inhabited or not.
Mike, what I keep imagining is if I'm some lonely traveler from another planet, what I think about the Earth from this altitude, whether I think it'd be inhabited or not.
Don't see anybody waiting, is that what you're saying?
Well, I'm just kind of curious whether I would land on the blue or the brown part of the Earth.
Because, of course, from that far away, the first humans to leave Earth, low Earth orbit, and see the Earth so small that you could cover it with, you know, at first your outstretched fist, later your thumb, there was no sign of civilization on the planet. And, you know, for Jim to actually voice that and be that imaginative, you know, the other thing I think about, too, that is just kind of one of these fun little details. Jim actually designed the mission patch for Apollo 8.
Yeah, the cool figure eight loop around the moon and the Earth.
Yeah, you know, he and Frank were at North American Aviation in Downey, California. They were taking part in, you know, checking out their spacecraft eventually. And Frank Borman, the commander, was flying the T-38. Jim didn't have that much to do. And he had his little knee board, his little clipboard on the knee of his flight coveralls. And he sketched out that design and brought it. When they got back to Houston, he gave it to the NASA artist, and that got turned into their mission patch.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, and this artistic dimension of him that you just, mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's just, it sets him apart in my mind.
He definitely had a creative spark to him that really did set him apart. And, you know, you talk about Frank Borman, the commander of Apollo 8. One of the things that when people talk about the career of Jim Lovell that they overlook and I'd like you to talk about it just a little bit, is Gemini 7. Because that, you talk about a grueling mission. Could you tell our listeners what that was all about?
Well, you know, at the time, what they used to say, and you have to think about the Volkswagen Beetle of the 1960s, which, you know, I don't know that I've been in the new Volkswagen Beetle, but the old one was pretty darn cramped. And they used to say 2 weeks in the front seat of a Volkswagen. And that's about what it was. I mean, they were basically crammed into a space that, you know, was barely as big as a telephone booth. For 2 weeks, each man had about as much space as a telephone booth. And, you know, there's just, after a while, the novelty kind of wears off.
After 100 orbits, you know.
And they were running, by the end of the flight, they were running low on fuel. They were just kind of drifting. I think Borman was really starting to feel like, geez, I don't know if we're going to make it to the full 14 days. It was hugely important for the moon program. Gemini was the kind of the stepping stone, the proving ground that could enable NASA to do the Apollo missions. And one of the key milestones was, could you actually survive long enough in space to go to the moon and back? We didn't know that when Kennedy made his challenge. You know, Alan Shepard had been up for all of 15 minutes and only five minutes of that in zero G. Now Frank and Jim were supposed to be up there for 14 days. And so, grueling is certainly one way of describing it. They weren't even allowed to both take off their spacesuits at once for a while. And then finally they convinced the doctors that, you know, yeah, it's really okay. We can both get out of our suits. Please let us get out of our suits. They were too uncomfortable, even the special lightweight suits that they created for that mission. But like I say, late in the flight, they were running low on maneuvering fuel. And Frank was worried. Jim told me Frank was worried that they'd come down in some godforsaken stretch of ocean, you know, when they splashed down. And Jim said, don't worry, Frank, the Navy will find us. You know, of course, Frank was Air Force. So yeah. I'm sure Jim took a little satisfaction about, you know, was slightly teasing his commander about that. But they made it through. And you look at the pictures of them on the carrier deck with their 14-day beards, especially Lovell, and they look really happy to be back in the fresh air. And, of course, they had the glow of success from having accomplished this important milestone.
Yeah, well, just it's overlooked, but I think it's important because it just tells you a lot about the character of those astronauts to be able to endure that.
And the thing is, Jim was so unflappable. Mm-hmm. I mean, that, and I think they all were. But Jim really just was somebody who was never going to be off balance in a stressful situation. I mean, you can count on one hand, on even on Apollo 13, where things were obviously extremely stressful. There was really only one time when Jim got on the radio and sounded irritated and impatient, and it was because he was waiting for Mission Control to read up the critical checklist for reentry, powering up the dead command ship before they could come back into the atmosphere. But that, you know, other than that, and I've talked to other people about Jim. Ken Mattingly, who was supposed to be on the Apollo 13 mission and got grounded at the last minute because he had been exposed to German measles. You know, Ken said to me, I could not imagine a better guy to be in command in that situation that they had to go through. So Jim really did have that quality.
Well, he's always said that Apollo 8 was really the highlight of his career. That, you know, 13 was incredible and everything, but Apollo 8 was just such a great adventure. And for you and I, it remains, I think, some of our most cherished memories from childhood. You know, happening on Christmas Eve, to go out and look at the moon and realize, you know, after you look at your Christmas tree and you go outside and it's on TV and you go outside and look at the moon and you go, there are astronauts up there right now. And they made it. And Jim Lovell especially made that experience so special where you felt like you were with them. Can you maybe pick out some of your favorite memories of that?
Well, yeah. I mean, like I say, I was 12 years old. I was glued to the TV. During those TV transmissions, I just remember Jim's voice kind of narrating, you know, what are the, Mike Collins says, well, tell us about the colors. And he's like, well, waters are sort of a royal blue and the clouds are brilliant white. And then you can see the browns of the land masses. And it just was mesmerizing that here were people, you know, in deep space for the first time in human history, able to see the Earth as a planet. And of course, when they were in lunar orbit, the same telecast in which they read from Genesis, Jim offered a description of the Earth as seen from lunar distance as a grand oasis in the vastness of space. I mean, that is positively poetic.
That is poetic. I never will forget those words. And I remember hearing them, you know, firsthand right there, hearing those words. And just, that was when I just, this is my guy. This is my favorite astronaut.
And what we didn't know at the time, what we didn't have access to at the time, and I had never even known about these onboard voice tapes that, you know, the recorder in the command module would be turned on automatically as the spacecraft went around behind the far side of the moon. So, you know, while they were out of radio contact with Earth, the recorder was capturing their private conversations over the lunar far side. And, you know, you can actually go on the web and go to the Apollo 8 flight journal and listen to these recordings, and the transcripts are there too. And there's one sequence during, I think it's maybe it's the seventh orbit. It's more than halfway through their time in lunar orbit. They spent 10 orbits around the moon, but they're over the lunar far side, and Jim is looking through the navigation sextant, which magnified things about 28 times. And he says, boy, you ought to see the lunar surface with this 28 power scope. This is utterly fantastic.
This is fantastic.
And I was just so thrilled when I read the transcript and later heard the tape, because you feel like, yes, here is a guy who is bringing us into the spacecraft with him. Not, of course, that was his intention, but it's the effect of, you feel like you're a stowaway on this incredible adventure.
Could you talk a bit about Jim's role on Apollo 8? Because he had some very specific things that he had to do that were important. They all three did. Bill Anders did. Frank Borman, the commander, did. But tell us about his role on Apollo 8.
Right. So Jim was the navigator, which obviously, if you're going to fly all the way from the Earth to the moon and back, that's pretty critical. And, you know, particularly as a backup measure, if they lost radio contact with mission control for some reason, you know, Jim was going to be the guy to figure out whether they were on course, what they needed to do to get on course if they weren't. And he was going to do that by sighting through the navigation optics in the command module, where he could sight on stars, measure the angle between the star and the edge of the Earth, what they call the limb of the Earth, and put those things into the computer. You sight on a star and you press a button on the computer to mark that position. The computer knows which star you're looking at. Then you go to one more star, and that angle between those two stars and the Earth gives you your fix in space. And so Jim became very skilled. Of course, having been to the Naval Academy, I'm sure he studied a lot about celestial navigation, because you got to know that as a sailor. But now in deep space, that becomes your lifeline across the great translunar ocean, if you will. And at one point during the mission, Jim, you know, was making star sightings, and I think the ground told him, mission control told him, hey, man, you're doing really, really well. You're about at the theoretical limit of accuracy of the instrument there. So, you know, Jim was very impressive in that role as a navigator. When they were in lunar orbit, his navigation duties really centered around sighting on landmarks on the moon. And one of the things they were doing on Apollo 8 was scouting the approach path to the landing site in the Sea of Tranquility, where months later, you know, 7 months later, Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin would try to land. And of course, at that time, we didn't know it was going to be Neil and Buzz, but that site had been picked out. And Jim even named a feature on the moon, a triangular-shaped mountain, along the approach path, what they call the initial point in that approach, which he named for his wife. He called it Mount Marilyn. And that name was only a few years ago approved by the International Astronomical Union. So that is a full-fledged named feature on the lunar surface. But Jim was looking through the telescope and making navigation sightings quite a bit during their time in lunar orbit.
Well, Andy, before we let you go, I know you were at the memorial services for Jim Lovell. Could you tell us just briefly a little bit about what that experience was like for you?
Oh, it was very moving. My wife, Vicki, and I did go. We were invited by the family. We were very grateful to be invited. And, you know, it was at the Naval Academy, where, of course, Jim was an alum. And the chapel at the Naval Academy is just a beautiful structure. And when we were sitting in that space, that beautiful space, and seeing Jim's casket with an American flag draped over it, and seeing the family come in, obviously very emotional. Tom Hanks was walking with them. Charlie Duke was walking with them. Both Charlie and Tom gave very nice remembrances of Jim. And it was a beautiful, sunny mid-October day. We walked from the chapel to the gravesite, which was a beautiful spot, kind of on the knoll of a hill. And it was a funeral with full military honors, the honor guard, the 21-gun salute, the missing man flyover of jets. Just really a moving experience.
And of course, this is, you know, thinking about Jim and being laid to rest next to his beloved wife, Marilyn, who passed away in 2023, you know, in the same month of August. You know, that all three of the astronauts had very long-lasting marriages. And that's kind of astounding when you think about the history of the Apollo program, the pressures and the times. But it's just so lovely that they're, you know, they're all together. And it's so sad for us to think that this is going to be the first Christmas since I was 8 years old that there will be no members of the Apollo 8 crew.
I know. It gets harder and harder to come to grips with that. And, you know, that's why we're the generation who knew them and have to keep the fire burning. And that's what we work to do, you know. So hopefully things like this podcast will do that.
Well, nobody does that better than you, Andrew Chaikin, and I'm very grateful for everything you've done for me over the years and for sharing your memories of our hero, Jim Lovell. Just what a fabulous human being and astronaut and father and husband and just all around great guy.
Absolutely. And I really, Dave, appreciate the chance to do this.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we come back, we'll continue our special Blue Dot tribute to the life of Gemini and Apollo astronaut Jim Lovell. He passed away this August at the age of 97. And we're back, and thanks for listening to this special edition of Blue Dot as we look back at the life of NASA astronaut Jim Lovell. Our next guest is someone who knew him intimately as her father. We're joined by Barbara Harrison Lovell, the eldest of the four Lovell children. Barbara, welcome again to Blue Dot.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
Well, you know, we are living longer, and it's interesting. I just lost my father last year. He would have been 100. This last week.
Wow.
And it's just amazing how, you know, we kind of go through those roles of there are mom and dad growing up. And then when they really get up there in years, you kind of start to kind of shift that role where you're kind of helping to take care of them. I'm just curious, you know, what was your mom and dad like for you, like, you know, like the last 30 years? Tell us about them, because they were together. They had a marriage that lasted so long, and which is so unusual for that era of Apollo. There's so much stress on those marriages. But famously, your parents stuck it out all the way. So tell us about what they were like as a married couple.
My family growing up, my parents were very caring and loving towards us. My mother was the one that held the fort down. My dad was busy doing what he did best, which was training and flying. And my mother was the support of NASA and astronaut wife that she could be for us.
And, you know, it's really interesting. I like to think about my parents, you know, back when. But we never think about, like, our parents meeting and dating. Did you ever really get the story about, you know, how your parents met and what that was like for them? Because it's always weird as a child to think about your parents being, you know, a romantic couple.
We've heard those stories for years. They met when they were 14 and 16. And my dad, his date decided that since he was not going to be homecoming king, that she was going to take someone else. And so my dad needed a date. And so he saw my mother and he said, why don't you date, you know, go with me to the homecoming dance. And she said, well, I don't know how to dance. And he said, I'll teach you. So that was the beginning. And they started dating in high school and then ended up going, and she ended up going out to Annapolis. Not, she lived there. She went to George Washington University in D.C. while my father was finishing up there.
And you weren't the only child. So tell us a little bit about, you know, the Lovell family growing up.
Well, I was the oldest, and everyone keeps telling me, you know, that you're the older one. And so that's a lot of privileges that came with that. But there's the four of us. I was the oldest. And then Jeffrey came when I was 12 years old, which was a surprise, but a very pleasant surprise. And then I have a brother that's, oh, I guess 16 months younger. Then I have a sister that's about 4.5 years younger. Then there's Jeffrey. And we all add a different element to the family. And we kind of laugh because Jeffrey, who was doesn't even remember Apollo 13. He knows every stat, anything about Apollo, Mercury, and Gemini. And, you know, matter of fact, he even is down at NASA giving tours. That's his favorite thing to do.
And one of the things that I love about talking to you is that your parents, your father lived this extraordinary life. Larger than life, you know. It's like not too many people have an actor like Tom Hanks play them on the big screen, you know. And he was famous, and I knew who he was. And I want to tell you this. I get asked this question all the time: who was your favorite astronaut, Dave? Because it's like, and I always give the standard. Well, that's like asking you know, who's your favorite kid? They're all great. Had a lot of them on, and they're all wonderful. But your dad was my favorite. And I glommed onto him. I don't exactly know why, but there was something about him when I first started watching his Gemini missions and then Apollo 8, of course. But he was special. He had that twinkle in his eye and his great sense of humor to him. And he just seemed so smart and such a good communicator. That's what I loved about him. So I'm just wondering, what was he like at home?
Much the same. He sat there and he helped us with our homework. We sat down and had meals every single night. That's what he wanted when he was home. When he wasn't home, we kind of managed to stay the same way in the family. Everybody had their role. And I tell people that, yes, it was dangerous what he did. And we were pretty much kept away from some of that knowledge. But, you know, today's military kids, their moms and dads go off to deployments, and that's even more, you know, dangerous than what my dad did at times.
Yeah, and when he was flying was during the Vietnam era, and a lot of his friends, you know, that he flew with in the Navy, you know, they went off to Vietnam. So, yes, you know, a lot of people fail to think about that when they think about, you know, how brave the astronauts were. And they were, you know, incredibly brave. But there's all kinds of things that can happen to you in life. Yeah,
exactly. And, you know, a pilot's a pilot. That's what they sign on to do.
Yeah, one of the things that really strikes me about him is I was reading a story about your grandma. And how she directed him, you know, he was going to do something else. He wanted to get into rocket science. He wanted to be a rocket engineer. He was building rockets when he met your mom, you know, when he was a kid. And he was really interested in that before that was even a thing. You know, your dad was into rockets. This is like, you know, way before the space program. But then your grandma convinced him to go to the Naval Academy. I'm just wondering if you could maybe tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. They didn't have any money. They were poor, poor, poor. They lived in a one-bedroom apartment. My grandmother lived on a bed that came down out of the wall, and he slept on the couch. And so he didn't have money to go to college. But her brother was at the Naval Academy, and she suggested that he, you know, apply there, which he did. He did not get in right away. And because of that, he had heard about the Holloway program, where after World War II, the Navy was looking for more pilots. And this Holloway program would have you come. He went to the University of Wisconsin, study there for 2 years. I think you become, you know, you get into the Navy and you do your thing and finish out later on. And so that's what he was going to do. But then after 2 years, he got accepted into the Naval Academy. And his commanding officer just said, you know, Lovell, if you want to make it a career, then you need to get over there. So that's what he ended up doing. He had, I think, decommissioned something like that and take his uniform off. And he started all over. But that was his goal. You know, that's what he wanted to do. That's what his whole career path was all about.
What were some of the things, as you know, once he left the space program and went on to the other parts of life, what were some of the things he really enjoyed working on and doing?
Oh, well, they built this house in Horseshoe Bay, Texas, and he loved going down there. And my dad never fixed anything growing up. He never puttered around, but there he just let it go. He enjoyed picking up things, checking on the engines, sweeping things out. But the most important thing he enjoyed was when grandchildren would come and he would take them around. You know, he would pull them on their little inner tubes, and it would scare them to death because he was so funny. He would go too fast and they'd be flipping off right and left, and my mother would be yelling at him to stop. But he enjoyed that. He enjoyed the grandchildren. Whenever we would go to Chicago, where he lived and worked for a while, every time a holiday would come up, we would end up going to one of the museums there. And my kids loved it. That's how my children remind him of the granddad that would take him on little trips and little errands like that.
That's fun. That's the fun part of being a grandparent right there.
I think so. You know, and that he also had his two airplanes. My mother called one of them the Puckett-a-Puck. You know, she said, Jim, I don't want to go on the Puckett-a-Puckett-a-Puckett-a. And so he ended up buying a little bit faster airplane that didn't make those sounds. But, you know, he would fly back and forth. That was his other love of life, was wherever he wanted to go, he would just take his plane. I had a friend whose mother passed away, and so he just flew me from San Antonio to Houston. He said, I'll get you there. And so he did. He loved doing things like that.
Yes, he really did love to fly. And how long was he flying up till?
I'm not sure. I know he gave it up sooner than, like, Bill Anders didn't give it up right away. But he gave it up. He came to us one day and he just said he was going to sell his airplane. And, you know, we kept, and we said, Dad, you just need to have a pilot with you. Just hire somebody to fly with you. He doesn't have to do the flying. And he goes, well, what am I going to do when I get there? And he said, we go, just send him home on a a commercial aircraft. But I think that was just beneath him.
Yeah, I could see that.
It got to the point where the insurance for him to fly got higher and higher, and the cost of keeping up the airplane, it became
too much.
Yeah, too much. So we ended up just selling the plane. And he said, I'd rather sell the plane than give that problem to you. And so he did sell it to a couple of men who are, they're Southwest pilots. And so my brother looked them up, and they came to a little airport near where my parents lived. And we took my dad out there and he could see the airplane and they got to meet him. So that was fun.
Oh, that's lovely. Well, before we let you go, you're on your way over to England soon. You want to tell us about that and why you're going?
Yes. There is a group, Global Space Awards. And I'm not sure if they're based in London, but there's this big gala and they give out awards for anything in space to different people. And this year they are, they have started a new award called the James A. Lovell Award. And it's for anyone, it will be given eventually to people who kind of follow in my dad's footsteps and the way he lived his life and the way he worked in his career path and what he stood for. And so we are the recipients this year of that, which is such a lovely honor for all of us. You know, all these things are just an honor for us. You know, we just grew up with a dad who we knew as dad.
Sure.
And even after his funeral service, this full military service, which it was such an honor for us to see that.
And that was at Annapolis, right?
It was in Annapolis, right. My mother planned the whole thing. We had all of her handwritten notes, even though she wasn't there. We all said she would be so pleased. She had scripture, she had hymns and everything. And so it was an honor. It was an honor for us.
Well, Barbara, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, David. I appreciate it.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we come back, we'll conclude our look back at the life of astronaut Jim Lovell when we talk to retired NASA flight director Jerry Griffin about his friend and colleague who was one of the first to the moon on Apollo 8 in 1968 and the commander of Apollo 13 in 1970. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot as we pay tribute to the life of Gemini and Apollo astronaut Jim Lovell. Lovell passed away at the age of 97 earlier this year. Our next guest is somebody who worked closely with Lovell and knew him well. Jerry Griffin was a NASA flight director during the Apollo program and was on hand for the harrowing flight of Apollo 13 in April of 1970. He was also the technical advisor for Ron Howard's 1995 film Apollo 13, starring Tom Hanks as Commander Jim Lovell. Jerry, welcome once again to Blue Dot.
Thank you, Dave. Always nice to be with you.
And of course, we're here to remember the life and career of the great Jim Lovell, who passed away in August, and just what an amazing career he had, what an amazing guy he was. So I'm wondering, do you remember like your first impressions of Jim Lovell?
I do. He got to the Manned Spacecraft Center, now the Johnson Space Center, in 62, and I didn't get there till 64. But when I got there, I jumped immediately into the beginning of the Gemini operations. So I was kind of embedded for a head down trying to learn all the NASA jargon and all that. And then Jim showed up sometime in my vision or in my memory that it was during the early prep for Gemini 3, which was Grissom and Young.
And which was the first flight.
First flight of the Gemini. The other two were unmanned. And then he started showing up. He was in the control center, and I got to meet him, and he just said hello. So I just got to know him, and then all of a sudden, here he comes up in the crew list where he's going to be eventually. This took a while, but he was going to be on Gemini 7.
With Borman.
With Borman, his classmate. And it's going to be a long-duration flight, but it was going to involve a bunch of rendezvous with something called the Agena. It's an unmanned upper stage of a rocket that the Air Force used. And we were going to dock with it and separate and come back again and separate and come back again. I think four dockings. But it was a long mission. It was planned for that from the very beginning. And it was a ordeal. It was a tough flight. But when you get a crew that's really number one, then the flight ops guys are really involved with them because you're running simulations every day. You're going through mission rules. You're going through flight plan to make sure everybody's on the same page. So I got to know him in that process, and I could tell he was quick, but so was Borman. And so I didn't think too much of it at that point. But then they flew and ended up flying almost 14 days.
I think, you know, that mission, Gemini 7, maybe one of the most undertold stories of the space program, of the golden age of space flight back in the 60s and early 70s, because that was, I don't know, hands down, aside from Apollo 13, because of the survival aspect of that and the danger, it was grueling.
It was. And, you know, that there's a small spacecraft. When you get in there with two guys or two astronauts of any kind, it's crowded and you don't have much room to move.
Okay, well, he flew two Gemini missions, right?
Right, flew 12. And actually, that was the icing on the cake. I always thought of 12 that way because we had learned so much about, well, Rendezvous wasn't such a big deal after all. It wasn't all that tough. I thought it was going to be much tougher than it was. And in fact, we've never had a big problem with Rendezvous in any of them. I'm knocking on wood as I say that. But what we've really learned is we didn't know much about going outside, an EVA, extravehicular, spacewalk, the more common term. When we first started, even on Gemini 4, as early as Ed White, when he just got out without anything, was how difficult it was to do anything without foot restraints and handholds and things like that. But we really learned it in later Gemini flights. And by the time we got to a Gemini 12, when Buzz went out, he did everything that we were going to do later with foot restraints, the proper kind of handholds, proper kind of tethers, and so forth. So 12, like all of Gemini, I think the Gemini program, if it had a legacy, is that it taught us how to go to the moon. And it's part of Apollo to me. So is Mercury. Mercury just said we could put some people in orbit and get them down and they'd be okay. Gemini really taught us how to do it.
What was the purpose of the Gemini program? Really, it was to figure those things out. Before you go to the moon, you've got to learn how to link up two spacecraft in orbit. You've got to learn how to go outside the spacecraft. You have to know how to do all those things. You got to rendezvous and dock. You know, so all of those lessons, you know, were so important to learn before you can even think about going all the way out to the moon.
And Jim Lovell played a key role in that with both of his flights, because one was duration, proving that it could be done, and you could go 2 weeks, essentially, in space and survive. We didn't need 2 weeks on the Apollo flights later, but we chewed up a bunch of days on every one of them. But Jim played a role in that, and then he played a role, big role in the rendezvous and docking, what I would call the final test. And so he was ready, I think, to get out of that spacecraft and get to the next one.
One of the things that stands out to me about Jim was he was a great communicator. He could convey big ideas, and he was just very fluent in the way he spoke, very natural. And he just had that quality of leadership and being able to let you know, what this was all about and what it was like. And he was a great ambassador for the space program when he was an astronaut.
Yep. And you hit a word I was going to give you before you said it. He exuded leadership. After I got to know him better, it was clear that he had those leadership qualities that he inspired people to do good things. That's what a leader does. A manager, you know, manages people and projects and that kind of thing. But a leader really inspires people to do their best. And Jim was one of those. And he didn't often show it. He showed it quite often, I guess, but he had a great sense of humor.
He did.
He could mix in with it that just made it even more effective. And to people that had done things that were risky in their life before, which he had, he made so much sense. And his kind of a real approach to every problem. And of course, that leadership followed him after that. That ability followed him after he got out of the astronaut corps, after he got out of NASA. Same thing.
Of course, he never got to, you know, achieve his dream and goal of walking on the moon. But if you look back at the Apollo program, you know, it's hard to argue with two of the greatest missions.
Yep.
Were eight, you know, the first trip out into deep space to the moon, which was so dramatic. And 13, the epic story of survival. Without those leadership skills that you just described, you know, things may have not gone as well as they did.
Yeah, you know, the other thing Jim had, and this was where it came into play in spades in Apollo 13, he had a calmness about him that you could tell he was never panicked. I never saw him, even when there were troubles. You know, we had plenty of them in Apollo 13, but he never exhibited any sort of panic.
I always loved the nickname that Pete Conrad gave him way back, Shaky.
Yeah.
You know, which is like, you know, it's kind of just this the opposite of what he was.
Right.
It's just so funny. It's like, oh, you know, Shaky here can pass muster. I don't know.
That was Conrad. Yeah, he had a way of picking those things out. And Jim was just one of these people that you wanted to be around, too. He really was.
And before we let you go, you were at the memorial service, which sounded very special, at the U.S. Naval Academy at Annapolis. And I know that your friend Charlie Duke, one of our last moonwalkers from Apollo 16, you know, said some nice words. And so did Tom Hanks, who famously portrayed Jim Lovell in the movie Apollo 13. Just maybe some quick impressions of what that special day was like, remembering Jim and with, you know, everybody who loved him and knew him there.
It was a very interesting day. A military funeral by itself has some solemn moments, and it has to. And you've got the casket there with the flag and the chapel first with the Navy guys bringing it in and so forth. So it has those solemn moments. But I can tell you, the day was upbeat. For one thing, the family, I think, they were upbeat because they were obviously sad down deep, but they were actually, I think, all saying, good show, Dad or Granddad or whoever. It was a great show, 97 years of it, and rest in peace.
Yes, and I think it was a comfort to the family to know that Jim and Marilyn, Mom and Dad, Grandma and Grandpa were back together again.
Yep.
Jerry, thanks so much for joining us to share your memories of Jim Lovell, one of America's finest astronauts, one of America's finest citizens of all time in my book.
Yeah, and you know, he was a great American. He all of the things that you could say he had a great success in the industry business world after he got out. And then he gave back so much of his time and treasure to make sure the space story was told correctly.
Yeah, we should all hope to live a life as well as he did.
Yep, I agree.
Thanks again to our guests, space historian and author Andrew Chaikin, daughter Barbara Lovell Harrison, and retired NASA flight director Jerry Griffin. Our deepest condolences go to Barbara and her siblings, Susan, Jay, and Jeffrey, and all of the Lovell family on their loss. Before we go, I thought we'd close with Jim Lovell reflecting on the meaning of the Apollo 8 mission, which he considered the high point of his career. This is the first Christmas since that amazing Christmas Eve in 1968 when the Apollo 8 astronauts, Lovell, Frank Borman, and Bill Anders, are no longer with us. Here's Jim from a talk he gave at Washington National Cathedral just before Christmas, 50 years after the mission.
Seeing the Earth at 240,000 miles my world suddenly expanded to infinity. I put my thumb up to the window and completely hid the Earth. Just think, over 3 billion people, mountains, oceans, deserts, everything I ever knew was behind my thumb. As I observed the Earth, I realized my home was a small planet, one of nine in the solar system. It is just a mere speck in our Milky Way galaxy and lost to oblivion in the universe.
Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of Chico State Enterprises and licensed to California State University Chico in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot. And Godspeed, Jim Lovell.